your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Universal basic income, sometimes referred to as UBI or guaranteed basic income. It's an often proposed approach to dealing with widening income inequality and the ever-growing threat of jobs being offshored and automated. UBI, which is what I'm going to refer to it, lest it seems so long-winded, UBI has been embraced by some on the left, some on the right, and by libertarians such as Milton Friedman. And UBI has been opposed by some on the left, some on the right, and libertarians. Well, to help explore the issue fairly, I am pleased to have recruited knowledgeable advocates, a knowledgeable advocate of UBI. He is Andrew Yang. He is running as a Democrat for President of the United States in 2020, and whose number one campaign issue is that he wants to enact UBI. Andrew Yang, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. And we have a knowledgeable opponent of UBI, Mark Jaffe. He is a senior policy analyst for the Reason Foundation and an opponent of UBI who wrote an article in the Fiscal Times called Universal Basic Income, an idea whose time should never come. Mark Jaffe, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Great. So, Mark, you're speaking a little close to the phone because you're distorting a little bit, so pull back just a little bit. So here is the plan structure. I did share this with both of them in advance, but dear listeners, I want you to know where we're headed here. It's what I call a modified debate. You see, debates plus its advantage is that it encourages a clash of ideas. But debate has a minus, and that is that neither party attempts to be statesmanlike only to win the debate. We're going to use what I call a modified format that encourages the best of both, and here's how it's going to work. Each of the two people have an opening statement of 2 minutes each. The pro-UBI side, that is Andrew Yang, will go first to reduce the audience being confused. The pro side, it's easier to keep in mind that that's what's first. And then there's going to be a free exchange between the two debaters for roughly 10, 15 minutes, keeping each comment concise and civil so that no one person dominates. And what's unusual in this modified debate format is I'm going to encourage each of you to acknowledge each other's good points. And I may interrupt if there's a question I think the listeners want addressed at that point, or I might interrupt if I feel someone's talking too long, being uncivil, which I do not think is going to happen, or going off topic. And I'm going to end that part of the modified debate at roughly 15-minute mark, or a few minutes earlier if it seems that the discussion is reaching a point of diminishing returns. For example, when there's too much redundancy, or the points that were made seem not that important. Then I'll end by having both people give a closing statement of 90 seconds each. Again, the pro-universal basic income side will go first to avoid the audience being confused. And both of you, please, try to not pre-plan those, but rather listen to what really went on during this debate, and so that your conclusion reflects that discussion rather than, you know, being just a priori, and including the good points made by your opponent. The last thing I want to say is, because I put myself in the shoes of you, my dear listeners, I sent them both a few questions that I was hoping that they would, in the course of the debate, address. So that's all you need to know. And so now, without further ado, Andrew Yang, please start by, you've got 2 minutes to make an opening statement about why you think universal basic income, UBI, is a good idea.
Well, I'm running for president on this idea because we are in the midst of the greatest economic and technological transformation in the history of our country. Donald Trump is our president today because we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and other Midwestern states. And my friends in Silicon Valley, where you are, know that we're about to do the same thing to millions of retail jobs, call center jobs, fast food jobs, truck driving and transportation jobs, as well as eventually white-collar jobs like accounting and being an attorney. Now, people think about universal basic income on the macro level, but I want everyone listening to this to think about what it would mean in your life and the life of your friends and neighbors and family members. Would it make you healthier? Would it make you mentally healthier? Would it strengthen your relationships if you were getting $1,000 a month and everyone else was too? Would you be able to do the sort of work that you truly want to do? Would it lead some people to even start new businesses and become a catalyst for untold entrepreneurship, creativity, and artistic pursuits? It would do all of these things. It would lead to a better way of life for all Americans. And the truth is, we're being pushed to an historic choice because the alternative, if we follow capital efficiency and the logic of GDP, we will have much, much worse than Donald Trump in our hands in just a few short years.
Thank you very much. Now, Mark Jaffe, you have 2 minutes to make the argument why you think universal basic income is not a good idea.
Thanks, Marty, and thanks, Andrew. 15 years ago, Governor-elect Gavin Newsom was a supervisor in San Francisco. He observed a serious problem with how the city addressed homelessness. The city provided homeless individuals a $395 monthly stipend, and recipients often spent the money to buy drugs. Newsom proposed a ballot measure entitled Care Not Cash, which reduced the stipend from $395 to $59, channeling the savings into homeless services such as supportive housing. The episode shows that many people cannot be expected to spend cash grants responsibly, a fact widely understood by San Franciscans who passed the measure. While some can be expected to misspend their UBI checks, many won't even need them. Under most UBI plans, including Andrew's, Jeff Bezos would receive a monthly stipend. For him and many others in the 1%, UBI payments will be a rounding error in their total wealth. It won't affect their behavior at all. So many UBI payments will prove to be a waste at a time when we can ill afford waste. The nation is projected to run trillion-dollar deficits for many years to come. These deficits will be piled on top of a $22 trillion national debt. With interest rates rising, the cost of servicing the growing debt will take a larger and larger bite out of the federal budget. While I appreciate that Andrew is responsible enough to propose a new revenue source to pay for his universal basic income, we may very well need his value-added tax just to keep current deficits under control rather than to finance new spending. Finally, I do want to push back a little against the idea that automation is condemning millions of Americans to permanent unemployment and poverty. While that narrative may have seemed plausible a few years ago, it no longer fits today's economic reality. Today, unemployment is down to 3.7%, and hundreds of thousands of new jobs are being added monthly. Job openings exceed the number of unemployed. Meanwhile, expectations about the impact of artificial intelligence on the labor market are proving to be overblown.
I'm going to interrupt you at this point because you're a two-minute mark, so I'm going to, in fairness, interrupt you.
Okay.
So now I'd like to have an open, free discussion between the two of you for roughly 10 to 15 minutes. I encourage you asking each other questions as well as making statements, and keep it concise so there can be a lot of change of voices, which results in a vigorous exchange. Okay, whoever wants to start may start.
Well, sure. I'd like to start just by addressing some of Mark's points.
Sure.
So everyone listening to this knows that the economy is not serving Americans or humans very well at this point. The headline unemployment rate obscures the fact that 94 million Americans of working age are out of the workforce. Our labor force participation rate is down to 62.9%, the same levels as El Salvador and the Dominican Republic, and almost 1 in 5 prime working age men has not worked in 12 months. Our life expectancy has declined for the last 3 years. 8 Americans are dying of drug overdoses every hour. And rates of business formation, interstate migration, marriage, childbearing, all either at record lows or multi-decade lows, even as suicide rates skyrocket. So the headline unemployment rate, being 3.7%, is essentially government misinformation and malpractice at this point, and we all know it. Now, the fact that universal basic income goes to everyone, including the truly wealthy, is mitigated by the fact that, as Mark suggests, I want to pay for the freedom dividend with a value-added tax that would take a slice of every Amazon transaction and every Google search and return that value to the American public. So while Jeff Bezos might be getting $1,000 a month, he'd be paying the equivalent of tens, perhaps hundreds of millions into the system making his $1,000 a month stipend completely trivial. I'll stop there for just a second.
Mark, please.
Yes, could you just explain your value-added tax concept a little better, because, or a little, in a little more detail, because my understanding of value-added taxes is they tend to penalize people who are in the lower economic strata, who spend more of their income. Is that not the case with your value-added tax?
Yeah, so a value-added tax in a vacuum is considered regressive because poor people spend a higher proportion of their income on consumer staples than wealthy people. But keep in mind, in this case, we're taking all of that money and then some, and then returning it to every single American. So the only way your purchasing power would go down is if you're in the top approximately 8% of Americans.
Okay, so how would Jeff Bezos be paying all of this? Like, as you say, for Google searches or Amazon purchases, it seems like the incidence really falls on the person who's making the purchase, and Google searches are free.
Well,
so I'm not quite.
No, so
I'm not
Jeff
following
Bezos.
How,
Jeff Bezos has a net worth of $160 billion. So let's say he spends $100 million on a new mansion, which he does. He owns four or five mansions, as far as I know. And then all of the services he procures for that mansion, he's paying the value-added tax. Every time he takes his private jet, value-added tax. You know, so it would add up, in his case, to tens of millions of dollars easily.
Okay, so it would be on his spending, not on his income. I just wanted to establish that. Because
yeah,
I mean, if he wanted to really
true
have...
That Amazon would be paying some of the incredible gains from artificial intelligence and big data that right now evade taxes, would also be covered by the value-added tax.
Okay. I'm just curious, why wouldn't you, instead of using a value-added tax, use an income tax to pay for this? I mean, that would clearly hit Bezos harder than it would hit the average worker. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, the trap we're in, Mark, and I think you'd agree with this, is that the big winners from all this incredible technological innovation are going to be the biggest tech companies, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Uber, and on and on. And you and most everyone listening to this knows that those companies do not pay a whole lot in tax. Google's move is to say it all went through Ireland. Amazon's move is to say they didn't make any money this quarter. So income taxes are an increasingly poor way of generating revenue, and that's true for both individuals and companies. Every other advanced economy aside from the U.S. already has a value-added tax for this reason.
Got it. Okay. Not to belabor this point because it's a little bit outside, but I do think we've reached peak Google and Facebook, and I'm not sure that they're going to be the forces to reckon with in the 2020s that they are now, but that's somewhat irrelevant to the conversation. Let me address some of the important points you made about the increased suicide rate, the sense of despair and hopelessness that we have in large parts of the population now. It seems to me that with respect to labor force participation, you would have less labor force participation with the UBI. And the evidence I have for that is the way Social Security works. So Social Security is a UBI for people who are 66 or higher. And we find that labor force participation suddenly drops when people become eligible for Social Security. So my concern would be that many people would look at the UBI, especially in places where the cost of living is lower, because $1,000 is going to take you too far in San Francisco, but in places where the cost of living is lower, they may use UBI the way that they're using disability insurance as a way to exit the workforce early and lose a sense of purpose to life. And I think work is very important because it gives us a sense of purpose. It gives us a reason for a feeling that we're contributing to society, and that we're doing it in a way that contribution is objectively valued because somebody is willing to pay for it. So I think breaking the nexus between earning a living and and work, I think is it concerns me in that respect. What do you think?
Yes, I couldn't agree more that work is fundamental to the human experience, and the data clearly shows that idleness is not a positive thing, particularly for men, when you look at the numbers. But the misconception here is that universal basic income somehow mitigates work. It's actually very pro-work, and it helps expand the definition of the work that we do. So the specific points you raised around people stopping working when they get some sort of supplemental income, the studies and data I've seen show that two groups work significantly less when they start getting a universal basic income. The first group is new mothers who spend more time with their children, and the second group is teenagers who graduate from high school at higher levels. Other groups work at around the same level, or in some cases even more, in part because at $1,000 a month, that's below the U.S. poverty line, and it's not enough to prosper in virtually any part of the country, even the inexpensive ones. If you're a server at a restaurant making $22,000 a year, and I start giving you $1,000 a month, and you quit your job, you just took an almost 50% pay cut, and you are having a hard time making ends meet anyway. Now, if you keep your job, maybe cut back on one shift, you're making $32,000, and that's enough for you to be able to save a tiny bit, take your child out once a week, maybe pay for tutoring services, and get your head up. So this is not anti-work at all. This actually will encourage millions of Americans to do the sort of work that they want to do. And I just want to supplement this by saying that the monetary market and labor market is a terrible indicator of the value of work. And I will use my wife as an example. She is at home with our two young boys, one of whom is autistic, and the labor market and GDP would value her work at zero, when we all know that that's some of the most valuable work that anyone can be doing.
I appreciate that, and I've actually seen proposals to pay for the domestic work that the spouse who doesn't go into the office every day does. And to me, that's actually a stronger idea than a UBI paid, irrespective of whether you're making any kind of social contribution or not. And I just want to, you know, throw out one other alternative, which I've thought of, because again, I do think you bring up some really valid problems about people becoming despaired and not feeling that they contribute. The alternative that I would prefer to UBI is some kind of subsidized work scheme, where an employer may find that a particular employee may only have $5 or $6 of marginal value, and then the government or a nonprofit could top that up to get that individual up to $15 or $20 an hour. How do you feel about that?
You know, that in theory is a great idea, and it could work in certain situations. The reservations I have about it are twofold. The first is that when you travel, I spent 7 years working with the entrepreneurs of the Midwest and the South. So I worked in Detroit, Birmingham, St. Louis, Cincinnati, and other cities. And in many of these environments, it's not that they'd hire some person to do the work if that person was just a little bit more cost competitive. In many cases, the work that these people were doing has just been obliterated. Like, they used to need factory workers, and now they don't. And so it's not a question of just having the factory worker just be a little bit less expensive. The second thing is that in many of these corporate situations, you're going to be competing against software that has a marginal cost of zero. And so, for example, if you're a call center worker, and there are 2.5 million call center workers in the United States right now making $14 an hour, your competition is not someone making $10 an hour. Your competition is going to be artificial intelligence with an incremental cost of zero.
I would like to jump in here. Did you want to say something? I'd rather you say something, and then I'll jump in. Please go ahead.
Okay, I do want to push back on that a little. Right now, when I call a service number and I get the artificial intelligent bot, I'm saying representative pretty fast, and I think a lot of our listeners probably feel the same way.
In about four years, we're not going to be able to tell the difference.
Yeah, okay. No doubt at some point it's going to get there. I do think that UBI proponents tend to exaggerate how quickly that's going to happen, and that's why, you know, I wanted to make the case about the self-driving cars. You know, self-driving cars just aren't going to happen for a long time. We're going to need Lyft and Uber drivers for years and decades to come. You know, when when the real unemployment hits and when these jobs really are eliminated, you know, maybe that's another time to have this debate.
So two things. One, I talked to a senior executive at one of the large ride-sharing companies, and their internal forecast is that half of their rides will be given by autonomous vehicles within 5 years, and they're paid a lot of money to make that forecast. The second thing is that I get frustrated when someone talks about, like, needing like a particular signal or time frame to implement universal basic income while accepting that maybe at some point we'll need it. Because if you do this a little early, what it means is that we as a society have a chance to adapt and build new institutions to address the problems that we both agree on, and we alleviate untold suffering and misery and make millions of families and communities stronger. If we go too late or we wait around for the perfect signal, it could be literally cataclysmic for our society, where if you look around, we are disintegrating by the numbers. And for whatever reason, all of the signals that you and I agree on are being ignored anyway. So assuming that we're going to get our acts together when it's really necessary is giving us a bit too much credit.
Mark, did you want to say something?
Marty. No, Marty, you could jump in at this point.
I'd like to ask you each the hardest question I could come up with. I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the listeners. The hardest question for each of you that I think is germane and really central. And I'm going to start with you, Andrew. You know, the whole idea of universal basic income emanates from what you've been saying. Automation is going to eliminate lots and lots of jobs, and that people will be competing with artificial intelligence for lots and lots of jobs. Well, so there won't be this possibility of topping off income or whatever, but $1,000 a month isn't really enough for a person to live in most metropolitan areas. And let's say $4,000, which would barely suffice in here in the Bay Area, would be so expensive as to require taxing successful corporations at rates that would cause them to cut countless of the remaining jobs or go out of business, being unable to compete with, say, Chinese corporations. And it would eviscerate the middle class, which no matter how much we tax successful corporations, it's the middle class, because there's so many of them, end up paying the most and certainly the most painful share of taxes. Andrew, is $1,000 really enough to address the humane problems that you correctly point to?
Well, I think $1,000 is the ideal starting point, because at this point still, we do have a lot of employment in the economy, and $1,000 will help people make successful transitions. Now, over time, should we increase $1,000? Should we tie it to inflation? Could we potentially be in position, if technology really takes off, where we can actually move towards a society of relative abundance instead of a society of artificial scarcity, which is what we're in right now? I believe we can. But I think $1,000 is the optimal starting point, in part because it makes a huge difference. It's enough to make a huge difference in a country where 57% of Americans can't afford an unexpected $500 bill. Like, $1,000 would be a big difference maker, but it's not so high that it ends up completely changing our labor markets overnight.
Okay, Mark, now I've got one for you. Externalities like automation, which is we mainly focused on, but offshoring is real, and the truth is that ever higher skills are required and are going to be required in the information economy. That's going to leave many millions of Americans unable to be sustainably employed, let alone employed with full benefits such as health care. Do you not worry about the ethics of having all of those people living in such poverty and with all those the terrible things that we've both agreed exist, or don't care about the ethics, but you're simply pragmatic, do you not worry about that not providing some kind of a UBI leading to the sort of civil unrest we're seeing in France now?
The civil unrest in France, I think, is largely explained by increasing gas taxes. A problem that we're also having in California. So I'm not sure I would, I would sort of go there, but I do agree with you that there's this nightmare scenario where anyone who's below a certain skill level suddenly becomes unemployed, and there's a sense of a lack of fairness in our society that causes civil unrest. So I mean, I can certainly imagine that scenario. I don't think it's very likely, and I don't think it's something that's happening right now. With regard to offshoring, you know, one trend that we had several years ago was the tendency to move call centers over to the Philippines. And you know, a lot of those have been coming back because people don't want to talk to people in the Philippines because they're not culturally aligned, they have different accents, and so forth. So you often find that people who are local still have advantages, and I just really haven't seen the evidence. And I admit freely here, because I live in the Bay Area, I don't live in a place like St. Louis or Columbus, that maybe I'm not seeing it. But right now, I'm not seeing it. I'm seeing everyone who wants to work working at all skill levels. And until that changes, it's really hard for me to be able to support something that would be so disruptive to the finances of the government as this would be.
Okay, I'm sure, Andrew, you have a response, but maybe that's a good thing for you to incorporate in your closing statements, which it is now time for. So, Andrew Yang, who is our advocate here in favor of a universal basic income, you've got around 90 seconds, and to, in light of this exchange, what are the most powerful points you want to make in favor of universal basic income, while perhaps even acknowledging any good points that Mark might have made along the way?
Well, I spent 7 years working with hundreds of entrepreneurs and helped create thousands of jobs throughout the Midwest and the South, and I became convinced through direct experience that I was pouring water into a bathtub that has a giant hole ripped in the bottom, and that hole threatens to destroy us. It may not happen immediately, but the forces that led to Donald Trump's election are going to pick up steam and accelerate. And I feel so strongly about this that I have put everything down and I have devoted my life to making this case to the American people. I'm running for president as a Democrat and going to Iowa for the 7th time next week. And if you'd like to join me in building an economy that puts human beings first, that values us intrinsically, and that says the capital market does not get everything right, then go to yang2020.com and let's make it happen together, because we do not have that much time.
Thank you, Andrew Yang. And now the final closing statement. Mark Jaffe, you're the person here who is taking the anti-UBI universal basic income position. You have 90 seconds, roughly.
I just want to thank Andrew. I really appreciate your passion. Wish you luck in your campaign. For those of us who live in the Bay Area as opposed to the Midwest, we've walked across past countless people or sat across them from BART, and we know that those people, if they were given $1,000 a month, would be putting $990 of that into their arm. We've talked about the increasing suicide rate and drug overdoses. There are addicts all across the country who cannot be trusted to just spend discretionary income that way. So I think UBI has will have a lot of unintended negative consequences that we have to be very careful about. And finally, just with respect to the impending death of the Uber driver, that executive who gave the five-year forecast, may not have been there or may have given that forecast before Uber had a catastrophic crash in Arizona and their self-driving cars were completely banned. Again, I just don't think it's going to happen nearly as fast as most people think.
Well, I'm sorry. Did you want to say another thing, Mark? I'm sorry.
That's it.
Okay.
That's it.
Well, Andrew Yang and Mark Jaffe, thank you very much for providing indeed a most civil debate and bringing up some good issues. Thank you so much on giving me your. I know it's late at night for you. You're both back east, and it was gracious of you to do that. Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you both. Look forward to building a future to be proud of with you both.
There you go. Take care. Bye-bye. For
what
it's worth, here's my opinion. Hopefully it's modulated by what these guys said. As a human being, I cannot feel good about the level of income inequality at the extremes. The Jeff Bezos of the world, who are worth $350 billion or whatever, I think there is a cosmic justice to taking most of his money in one way, whether it be through a value-added tax or higher taxation or whatever, and giving it to people who don't have basic health care. And maybe even more important, because you give somebody money, you know, some of it is going to go up some people's arms, others certainly are not. But somehow to invest it in those people who are going to struggle in the ever more demanding information economy, in a capitalist, or even in a mixed economy, which is what we really have, even for government jobs, a hell of a lot of people who are not qualified to get a decent government job. So what I think I would put some of that money from the ultra, I would not touch, the middle class is struggling. They're hollowing out. I would hold their income solid. I would not increase their taxes in any way. But the ultra wealthy, I would impose a very heavy tax on their income and their assets, including the so-called death tax. Because I've had many clients who are trust fund babies, and getting the millions of dollars from their parents, again, not everybody, but tends to encourage what we decry the poor about in having a welfare mentality. You give them millions and they sit on their butt. That doesn't serve anybody. So I would heavily tax the really wealthy, and I would redistribute it largely, not in forms of cash, but in terms of basic housing, if they don't have it, basic health care, the same health care for everybody. I'm not in favor of that, but I'm not going to go into the reasons why right now. But basic housing, basic health care. I mean, if dorm housing and food in the dorms is good enough for Harvard students, it should be good for people who are unemployed. But everybody should have basic health care as a human right. Everybody should have basic housing, basic transportation, and probably government make-work jobs paid for by the ultra-wealthy. Now, if there is not enough money to go around, I'm not wise enough to have a great answer. But I think starting from that position of the extremes and investing in proven job training programs, not so, you know, everyone to college, we see kids go to college and they drop out at enormous rates, especially the kids who are getting in with poor qualifications or majoring in fields that where they're really not teaching critical thinking skills or computer skills or writing skills, but just activist skills, which is not going to make your living. So I think if we spent the money on proven training programs, not just job training programs, but citizenship training programs. I'm not so narrowly careerist as to say that. But that's what I would do in a nutshell. Again, to synthesize, I would take the money from the ultra-wealthy and tax them really heavily and redistribute it. Yes, that's a dirty word, but redistribute it to those people who simply cannot land a good job, a decent, livable wage job, predominantly to give them training to help them become more employable or to become simple entrepreneurs. By the way, my guest next week, which is why I'm having this guest next week, she's the district director of the San Francisco Small Business Administration, whose job it is to provide resources disproportionately to low and moderate income people to help them start businesses in case, you know, very often they can't be employed. So that's what I think. But I don't want to stay on that topic because I really like to make the first half of the show focusing on these big picture issues, but the second half of the show to focus on you, my dear listeners, as individuals. And I encourage what are called workovers. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. This is KELW, local public radio here in San Francisco. And I invite you to call if you have a work-related problem. If you're unemployed, or, you know, being fair to everybody, there are plenty of people who are very well-employed and miserable, either because of a crisis of meaning, or they hate their employees, or they feel unethical about their work, or they want to switch, or whatever. So no matter your station in life, if you have a question related to your work life, I invite you to call. Or if you have a story, human beings are not transformed as much by statistics and facts as they are by stories. And candidly, both of my guests were pretty long on the facts, but they were not story rich. And I think so I welcome you to call in if you have a story about your work life that might be illustrative to all of us in our work life. I invite you to call too. So, your question about your work life, a story about your work life, the phone number for either reason, I call them workovers. If the phone number here, KLW, and Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We already have callers on the line, so we'll go to the phones in just a moment as soon as we can get the call. It looks like we're going to take just another moment. And yes, let's go right to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hello.
Happy Hanukkah.
Okay.
Merry Christmas. Happy Kwanzaa.
Okay.
And then, oh boy, well, it's a Julian New Year. And then following that, we've got Martin Luther King's birthday. We've got...
What's your question about? What's your work-related question? And yes, year-end is a time when many of us are celebrating. Now, what's your question about work?
Oh, how are you going to establish peace on Earth?
Okay, I'm going to thank you for the call. You know what? I do think that work is a great healer. And indeed, providing good work, paid and not, as one of the debaters said, you know, clear, unpaid work like helping, you know, parenting, volunteer work. Simply when I write a ton of Amazon reviews, there's something wrong about my contributing to Amazon being able to get more customers because there's so many great reader reviews that people want to buy on Amazon. There's something wrong about that being unpaid. And I'm not sure micro payments is the answer. But in any case, I think there's many ways to get peace on Earth. But one of them certainly is to provide meaning for more people so that they don't feel they need to turn to violence, but they do work, whether it's paid or unpaid. We've got all the lines lighted up now. So let's. I'm going to go right back to the phones in a minute as soon as we can. Okay. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello? Hello. It's you.
Hello. Good evening. This is Sachin from Saffron Indian Restaurant.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Marty. How are you?
I am well. I guess I should... I know who you are. I'll tell the listeners what the story is. I love Indian food, and I happened upon a new Indian restaurant, and I spoke to the family. It's owned by the family, a very distinguished father who's the chef, and two sons who are working their butts off. And I was so inspired by their story that I invited Sachin to call in and tell the story. Would you briefly tell the story of your restaurant?
Sure. But first of all, I would like to thank you for giving us a chance to serve you for your lunch. thanks a lot. And with your permission, I'm going to share the story about how we come up with our Saffron Indian restaurant, being a software engineer, and my experience so far.
Great.
So we were in Boston. I live with my mom and dad there, and mom and dad lived there from last 30 to 35 years. And I was working with top MNCs as a software engineer, and because of my job, I had to move to San Francisco. I moved in San Francisco in August 2016. After moving here, after 6 months, I realized I can't stay away from my mom and dad. So then I start talking with my dad to move to Bay Area. Initial stage, dad was saying, no, I don't want to move because he lived in Boston from a long time, like 30 years, and he's having a big friends and, you know, all friend circle and a very good job there. So initially he was saying no, but I keep insisting again and again. And finally he said, okay, I will move, but you have to find something for me to work on. I can't sit idle at home. Then I talked with my manager at my office, and I requested him to give me some suggestion for a nice area so that I can open some restaurant for my dad. He suggested me for La Mirinda. I don't know what La Mirinda is at that time because I was very new to the area. I was looking for La Mirinda on the Google map. I found nothing, and then I start Googling about it and found like there are three cities. It's Orinda, Lafayette, and Moraga. I started my search with Lafayette. Lafayette is having two Indian restaurants. Moraga is having
one. I'm going to interrupt
Indian
you. You know what? I'm going to interrupt you for conciseness. What impressed me was a couple of things. Your father, what did he? He was not a chef. What did he do before being a chef?
So previously, in 70s, he was in the German. He was a German chef previously. He was in Germany till 82.
In Germany, uh-huh.
And yeah, after 82, in 83, he moved back to India, and he was working there as a farmer. So he worked as a farmer till 88 or 89, and then he moved to United States in 1990. And since 1991, I think, 1991, he's working as a chef since that time.
And what shocks me is how patient he is. He refuses... People will wait a long time because he cooks everything like it was my dad. When I go in there, I've been there twice now, It's like my dad is doing the cooking. He's so slow. Does it make you crazy? He refuses to speed up.
Yeah. So actually, when we opened, Dad follows a very slow cooking process. He prepares the dishes from the scratch every time.
I watch him. It's an open kitchen. Yeah.
Yeah, and I requested my dad to fast up, or you can cook the stuff in bulk so that we can heat and serve to the guests. He strictly said, no, I don't want to compromise with the quality, and he will do what he learned in the last 30 years. So he don't want to make any compromise on the foods, and he follows slow cooking process, and we do have some organic stuff which he likes to cook and serve to the guests. So that makes it unique with the taste, people are really liking over here.
One big question is this. You were software engineers. You and your brother were making a good living. You weren't getting rich, but you were making a decent living. It cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to open up a restaurant. You created it. It's gorgeous. It's very risky. Psychologically, philosophically, what enabled you to take the risks, all of you, of quitting your jobs, taking all your savings? It was all family money. It wasn't the bank. And dude, what went through your head psychologically, philosophically, that made you do that?
So for me, for our family, it's not about money. We are losing money. We are investing money. It's not a money thing. The only thing which we care is the family can stay together, and we can stay at one place, talk with each other every day, and help each other in everyday life. Why we opened this restaurant? Because I want to stay with my dad, and I want to help him as much as I can to establish him and his restaurant. Initial stage, when I opened this restaurant for dad, I was not thinking to be a part of it, but circumstances were like we were having some staffing issues, then I have to come in and help dad, and I quit my job because dad moved in Bay Area because of me, and it was my time to support him. So I quit my job and full-fledged jump into the field, and I called my brother-in-law, my sister, my mom from Boston, so everybody, all the relatives, come in, and we all started.
Both times when I came in, it was very interesting. I've been in many workplaces, and I see the stressed look on everybody's faces, how they're tired, they're drawn, and very often they don't believe in what they do. Both times I've come in, I come in at lunch when it's slow, but the whole family is there. They look relaxed. They're talking to each other. They're talking with the customers. They're friendly. There is something about the fact that it is so not money-centric, and there's no ethical compromises in the way in which you run your restaurant, and that it is the family working together. There's something right, and your dad is not young. He looks like he's got a very full head of gray hair, maybe 60 years old, something like that, 65. Is that right?
He's like 75.
75? Wow.
Yeah.
And there he's the only cook. He is doing the...
Yeah, he's the only cook.
Wow.
And right now he's forcing me to practice with him.
Yeah.
I don't know how to go with it, but he's just giving me small lessons and teaching me to be his helper, so I'm helping him in the cooking as well. But let's see how it goes.
Wow, think about that. My dear listeners, look at all the different challenges. A 75-year-old father who had lived for 35 years in Boston, who was a farmer when he went back to India at that age, and his sons, who were software engineers, quit and invested everything the family had to create a restaurant that is utterly not commercial, where it takes 20-25 minutes to make an item. This, to me, is an example of unsung heroism. And I can also tell you that apart from that, I wouldn't have had any of this reaction if the food was crappy. It was the best Indian food, both times, I have ever had in my life. Because it's not only is it fresh, but the spicing is so amazing. So I wanted to honor you and your father and the restaurant Saffron, which is in Orinda. And the prices are not crazy. The prices are normal human prices. So in the Hindus often, the way they give respect is they put their hands together like in prayer and they bow. I put my hands together in prayer and bow to you, and especially to your father.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling the show.
Yeah, just one second. If you allow me, I would like to thank San Francisco people and the La Mirinda community. These people are really supportive, helpful, and I got like big support from La Mirinda community when we open it. So big thanks to La Mirinda community and San Francisco as well.
I guess I do have one more
question. Thank you very much, sir.
I do have one more question. You're all very dark-skinned Indians, very, very dark-skinned. And Orinda is the whitest community in the Bay Area, basically. Have you encountered any racism? Could you say there's some
people? No, not at all. People love like anything. They treat us like a family members. I can't tell you. I have so many examples with personal experience how they treat us. They treat us like a family members. La Mirinda community, awesome people live here. I will be very thankful to the people.
Wow.
I never faced such things here.
Well, I look forward to coming back, and this time I think I'm going to have chana masala with paneer, okay?
Sure, sir. Thank you very much. Have a nice evening.
Take care. Okay.
Yeah.
That story is very inspiring to me, and hopefully to you. Let's go back to the phones, though. Let's welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
My mind has, in your books, do you put in any of your core beliefs?
Of course.
Oh, good.
How could I not? One does not write. I've written 12 books, but one does not write to make money. One writes to express your core views. Well, why do you raise that question, even?
Well, because core beliefs, some people have never pondered which ones they got. For instance, classic question in Western psychology is, who am I? And then you go da-da-da-da to 10, right? At any rate, when you look at the globe, they're different in different cultures. Do you happen to know the number for the Jewish year right now?
No, I have no idea whatsoever. You know what? I'm going to let you, this is a little off topic, so I'm going to let you go. We have other calls on the line. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? How can I help you?
Are you talking to me?
I am.
Well, I'm an East Bay native. I grew up in Oakland. My family has been here since the early 1900s. I'm a small business owner now, and I have a couple of partners. And I'm having some real quandaries about my career of choice and wondering what I should do at the age of 45 to change my career.
Tell me what you're doing now.
I'm a hairstylist.
Okay. And so I interrupted you, though. I should let you tell me more. Please continue.
I growing up here, I am not college educated. I'm not into tech. I'm not, you know, I've always been in some kind of service industry. And my body is kind of giving out, you know.
Yeah, you're on your feet all day, and your hands. Are you getting problems with your wrists and forearms?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, all that stuff.
Right.
And it's really hard to make a living here. Being a hairdresser, it's kind of like golden handcuffs a little bit.
Yes.
Because you know we make decent money, and you know I do have a sort of an entrepreneurial mind, but I'm considering going back to school. But when I do all these things to try and sort of figure out what would be a good niche for me, it's very challenging.
Okay,
you know?
Let me ask. Now I can interrupt you. So standard normal thing is when one has had a lot of years and has a big network, because your family, you stress the point right away in the beginning. Your family's been here for a century. Normally what happens is you don't do any more haircutting because we don't want you to be your hands to be crippled, and we don't want you on your feet all day. But you do end up training your replacement. Just like the previous call said, the father at age 75 is the chef but is now slowly training the son to do the same kind of masterful cooking at that restaurant, Saffron, that he did. Do you know, of all the people either who are currently working for you or of all the people your family's known over the long time they've been, is there somebody who should be, who you really trust to be the workhorse at haircutting, and you be the person who runs the business? And if you're going to go back to school, maybe learning the art of running a business more effectively so you can make more money in the Bay Area, or should you move to another geographic area, or should you change careers? Which one of those feels right for you?
Well, given the fact that the way we have our business constructed, we don't have a lot of extra cash laying around to have someone, basically, we don't make enough money on the business to actually take ourselves away from doing hair. And like I said, I have partners. So, you know, what feels right to me is to try and, you know, figure out something that feels like a better fit for me and get an education and go into something else.
Okay.
But it's really tricky.
Well, that's why you're calling. So I'm going to ask you some questions to learn something about you so that I can perhaps send you in a direction. What? Tell me one or two things that are about yourself in terms of what you're naturally good at or what you're excited to learn about. Tell me, start there.
Well, I mean, I've always been interested in different kinds of businesses that involve, you know, retail of some kind. But I'm not a very... I'm not into selling things that people don't want. So I'm not really a salesperson.
Right.
You know?
No good salesperson. Yeah, no good salesperson is to sell what people don't want. Those are sleazebags. Good salespeople sell great products that people want but don't understand and need to have explained to them and seeing if, in fact, it is right for them.
Yeah. I mean, I love traveling. I love learning about other cultures. I think that, you know, one thing I really enjoy about my job is all the different people that I meet, and I have the freedom to go and travel, you know. So I'm, you know, recently, you know, went on a trip and thought, oh, man, what's up with import-export? And then I started thinking about what's up with shipping and trade and, you know, international trade.
Okay,
and, you know,
I'm going to interrupt you.
Something.
I got it. Yeah. Are any of the following appealing to you? Because you know your business well, but there is everything. I mean, most wigs, for example, are imported. Many, very often, hair salons or whatever sell jewelry and other items. Could you combine your expertise with in the hair salon business and create new revenue and allow yourself to travel by getting stuff that is related to your business, importing it, since you say you're interested in shipping and importing, or would you rather be what's called an export agent or an import agent, which is you're just specializing in importing things, working for some other company and getting trained to do that? Which feels better for you?
I think that the second thing you said sounds better for me.
Okay. They're called import agents, and there are training programs both online and in person, which there's all kinds of rules. You see, I'm glad you said you're interested in shipping, because that's not sexy, but it's something that's necessary. Bills of lading, tariffs, exchange rates, packaging, insurance, all that stuff. And and that stuff is there's always going to be a need for that. Are you by any chance fluent in any other language?
Well, that's actually something that I'm about to start studying is Spanish, because I've been going to Spanish speaking countries enough that I figure, okay, it's time, you know. And I'm already absorbing Spanish just because I travel enough, right?
Okay.
So I am enrolled for a Spanish class, and I think the next time I go to Mexico, for instance, I'll do an intensive. I do feel like I should do that no matter what.
Great. And obviously we have a very large Latino population here. You know, when I think about stuff that might be able to be sold in a hair salon, that you could get in Mexico, it's silver. When I think of Cusco, and I think of their beautiful, like, turquoise and silver kinds of jewelry, and given we have such a Latino population, that might be of particular interest to them. What do you think about the idea of taking a course in import, and using that knowledge in your next trip to Mexico to go and be really smart about buying things that you think your customer base would like, maybe buying a few samples or buying a few samples long distance and seeing if they would sell in your store, and keep adjusting, but don't buy any huge amount of inventory, but buy a small amounts and then see if something really sells well, then see if you can get it in quantity. What about that idea do you like or not?
I love that idea, and I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for an actual reputable course or, you know, school or whatever.
The wisest approach is the following. It's no individual on the planet has more expertise than my best friend, Google.com. If you search, Google under importing courses, import agent courses, buying from Mexico, all of those things, and then read the reader reviews. Not one that, you know, a course that has three or four, because that means the person doesn't have a lot of experience, or it could be his buddies or her buddies writing the reviews. But if a course, online or in person, has 20 or 30 reviews, and they're, you know, nobody's going to get all 5 stars, but if it averages 4.5 stars, that's worth a shot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so you think import agent is a good thing to look into?
In just importing in general, I'm trying to leverage what you've got. It's because you've got two partners. It sounds like you're not ready to dissolve the business, but if you could add some revenue that's not going to require you burning out your hands and your arms and your forearms and being on your feet all day, while indulging your travel interest and desire to learn something new, that might be a way at age 45, without a major disruptive transformation, to make things work for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally makes sense.
Great. Well, thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
We have time for one more call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hey, hi, Marty.
Hello.
Hi. I'm in actually the same shoe as the girl, the lady that just called you.
Huh.
I'm in my, you know, early 40s.
Okay.
And I do have a great job, you know, that was able to help me to raise, as a single full-time dad, that will be able to help me raise my child in the Bay Area by myself for the last 4 years.
Uh-huh.
And I was able to have an opportunity to do an Ironman. And,
to do a what? I didn't hear that. I didn't understand that.
I have a great job that allowed me to do an Ironman. So I was able to train, and being a single full-time dad and manage a full-time job, and to be able to take care of my child. But so recently we decided to buy a property, and we have a 22-acre farm that we bought in the East Coast.
Mm.
And I still do have this job that I do enjoy, because it doesn't pay me a lot, but it allows me to take a bunch of young guys and help them through work. And half of the people that have worked with me has never really like run, and I'm able to get them running and changing their lives through working and through running marathons.
I'm going to interrupt you because we're out of time, but based on what you've told me, most farmers lose money. You need to, if you can find a tenant who will pay you good rent for that farm, great. But it sounds like, since you three times said you enjoyed the job, and in addition, you're mentoring young people and your job enables you to be a good dad, that sounds like you shouldn't give that up. It seems like you should put a lot of effort into finding a good tenant for that land. Or if it's something that where the land value is going up enormously, to simply wait it out if you can afford the cash flow. Anyway, that's all the time I had, but I wanted to give you as much as I could in the time that I had. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board. There's callers on the line, so please call back next week. You can't wait till the last second, unfortunately, but I'm always taking calls, so you can do that next week. Anyway, I want to thank, first of all, my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for calling in and listening. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. Yes, you can call in for a workover. Plus, I'll talk with Julie Clowes. She is San Francisco District Director of the Small Business Administration. She's going to talk about resources for the self-employed. That's one of the great ways to ensure your employability. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.